We shall turn to the Gospel according to Mark chapter 14, reading at verse 32. Mark 14 and verse 32. And they went to a place which was called Gethsemane, and he said to the disciples, "Sit here while I pray." I want to look at the verses down to the end of verse 42. Now, I've been asked to talk this weekend on three separate but related themes: Gethsemane, Calvary, and the road to Emmaus. But I want first of all to make some general point regarding Gethsemane, and then in regard to the whole block of subjects I want to deal with over today and tomorrow. To remind you first of all that we are indeed reflecting on the Son of God. I want us to bear in mind exactly who he is, and I say that because we're going to reflect primarily upon Christ in his weakness and humiliation, and I'm going to be skirting some of the most profound aspects of his abasement. I'm going to expose to you some of the key points, the Lord's evident weakness. In other words, our focus is falling very, very firmly upon the man, Christ Jesus, upon his humanity. And that's why I want us to bear in mind all the time that it is the humanity of the Son of God. I won't be focusing upon his deity, but I don't want you to forget his deity. That the humiliation, the weakness, is always that of God's own Son. My second concern is this: that you bear in mind that the Lord's humiliation is a progression. It isn't a point, it's a line. I know that when Christ took flesh and became the child in the manger, that was a momentous step. And I think that many of us are tempted to see that one step as itself the humiliation. Though it wasn't. It was indeed a gigantic step, but it is still only the commencement of the humiliation. Because Christ moves on from the manger, further and further and deeper into the abyss of his own chosen poverty. Indeed, Gethsemane itself is by no means the lowest point in the Lord's descent. It is still only a point on a line which leads to a much more profound humiliation of Jesus. The climax is upon the cross itself. And on the cross itself, indeed, there is still progression. As he moves deeper and deeper into what the cross itself actually means. My third point I mentioned more briefly, and it's this: that all we say, we are saying of the person Jesus Christ. Now, this is a slightly difficult point. I'm saying it for this reason: that sometimes we are tempted to divide the Lord's experiences and achievements between his divine and his human nature. And especially the budding theologians, I want to warn them that we seldom have the right to say that this is his divinity acting, or this is his humanity acting. I would seldom feel confident enough to be able to make that kind of allocation. And what I'm saying is simply that he suffers, that he is tempted, that he experiences pain and poverty, and at last that he dies. In other words, we aren't seeing in Gethsemane the weakness of the human nature of Christ. We are seeing the weakness of the person, Christ, the Son of God. And my fourth general concern is this. I want to remind you of how practical this and all our other subjects are. Let me say that I haven't chosen those topics. Let me say that it is immensely encouraging that you would ask to be addressed on what are profoundly theological themes. I think that for a long time the youth conferences, and I don't mean Free Church ones only, were very much obsessed with what people would call the very practical subjects. Evangelism and the whole area of how to live this life and how to do certain things. Now you ask me to deal with what is the profoundest area in the whole range of Christian truth, the suffering, the cross of the Lord Jesus Christ. At the same time, surely, the cross is something which is immeasurably and directly practical. Because it is at the cross we experience the constraint or the pressure of the love of God. If I would think that I can't avoid stretching your minds, I haven't been asked here to tell you stories or to give you statistics or to give you practical solutions with regard to, say, political problems. I've been asked to draw your attention to the cross. But what is practical in the Christian life? Christian practice begins with the worship of God and the adoration of God. It doesn't begin with helping the poor or evangelism. Worship is practical. Love for Christ is practical. And I would hope that by following your program, by focusing upon Gethsemane and Calvary and Emmaus, that you will get new insights into the glory of the Savior and feel anew the constraint of his love. Well, then against that background, let's focus on Gethsemane. It reminds us, first of all, of the depth of the Lord's emotional life. The depth of the Lord's emotional life. Now, those of Free Church background will recall that Christ became a man by taking a true body and a reasonable soul. So our catechism tells us. A reasonable soul. Now that means that Christ took an ordinary human psychology, the kind of soul, rational, psychic, emotional, affective soul, such as you and I have. And Gethsemane highlights for us just how real and how deep that emotional life was. The Lord had human feelings. Now I believe that the Lord had the whole range of human feelings, and I believe that he experienced, for example, the bright emotions of a human existence. I believe that the Lord was joyful, that the Lord was blessed, that the Lord was content. I believe that because the New Testament insists that we ourselves as Christians are bound to have those emotions. It even tells us that joy is the fruit of the Spirit. I know that the New Testament never tells us that Jesus laughs. It tells us that he wept but never that he left. But I also believe that we make far too much of that fact, of that omission. We Christians have no right to live lives without joy, without peace and contentment. And I believe that Jesus lived such a life in close fellowship with God. But there is no doubt at all that what the whole Gethsemane narrative emphasizes is the dark side of the human emotions. You see how it is in verse 33. He began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death." Now that brings out very clearly to us just how great the darkness in the Lord's soul was. There was sorrow, and it was an almost mortal sorrow. He was almost heartbroken, exceeding sorrowful unto death. We are told too that he was greatly distressed and troubled. It's rendered sometimes as being overwhelmed. He began to be sore amazed, to be almost overwhelmed. Indeed, we know that the same word is used in one gospel to express for us the kind of emotion the disciples had when they came to the tomb on the resurrection morning and they saw the empty tomb and they saw the angels. They were sore amazed. They were overwhelmed. Now, I think that deep in these words is the idea of the eeriness of the experience, the kind of feeling we might have if we saw a ghost, if we found ourselves in the presence of the uncanny, of what is overwhelmingly otherworldly, what might be called the goose pimple feeling, what makes your hair stand on end, the kind of feeling that we have in the presence of the absolutely holy and the utterly unfamiliar. That's what the Lord was. He was overwhelmed. It really expresses for us very, very effectively the fact that the Lord was standing on the threshold here of something utterly uncanny, that didn't belong to this world at all. Now, it's a feeling that some Christians can sometimes have in their own experience, that are things we go through, maybe bereavements or certain temptations, and we are powerfully conscious of the otherworldliness, of the eeriness of what we're facing. But the Lord had that. He was overwhelmed at this particular point, almost overwhelmed. So we have sorrow, we have this amazement. We know also from Hebrews that the Lord at this point experienced fear. He was heard in that he feared. He was really afraid. Now it may be very difficult for us to believe all of this. Here, as I said, is God's own Son. And yet he's in the depths of sorrow. He is in the depths of amazement. And he is terribly and terribly afraid. Now it seems to me something unspeakably precious. I know that maybe some of us haven't yet experienced, indeed none of us has experienced the full range of human emotions. But some of us may imagine that Christians will never go through depths of that kind. We imagine that maybe God's will always be easy. And yet here is the hour that God has given to Christ. Here is the cup given him to drink. And he doesn't find it easy. And that to me is something of enormous importance. Because I haven't always found it easy. And I'm called on to minister to other Christians who often don't find it easy. They find that the way God deals with them is terribly testing emotionally. And I live in a world where people tell Christians, oh, if you have real faith or strong faith, you don't feel these things. You don't feel temptation, you don't feel loss, you don't feel pain. And yet here is Christ, and he is entirely in the will of God. There is no question at all of us being on the wrong road, or of his emotions being sinful. And yet, how does he feel? He feels that he can hardly handle it, that he can't take very much more, that he's being stretched almost to breaking point. And what I'm hoping is that if and when in God's providence these moments of testing come on you, that you remember that you heard a man once telling you it wasn't going to be easy, but that one day you too might be called upon to experience just a taste of what Christ experienced in terms of the emotional depths and darknesses of his life. Now, some of you know them already better than I do, but I'm trying to say to you that the day you feel sorrowful, the day you feel overwhelmed, the day you feel afraid, don't say that day, my faith is gone. Don't say, I let the Lord down. Don't say, I need psychiatric treatment. Because here is somebody, God's own son, the perfect pattern, and he's finding it difficult to handle. He is here touched with a feeling of our infirmities. And I don't believe that the Lord has ever forgotten these moments in the Garden of Gethsemane. I believe that tonight he remembers very, very vividly how terrible and how almost unbearable it was. And I believe that when he sees us struggling, and when he sees us sorrowful and frightened, I believe he says, I understand. I know how she's feeling, because I have been in that kind of situation. It's also interesting to notice the comfort that the Lord sought. Here he is with these great emotions, this opening up of the great deeps of his own emotional life. And we find him in his humanness looking for comfort. And I think it's lovely the way our attention is focused upon the avenues along which the Lord did seek comfort. The first avenue was this. He took with him Peter and James and John. He sought comfort, first of all, in the physical presence of fellow human beings. It is, you see, so magnificent this, because maybe you've come to this conference to be transformed into some kind of superman, some spiritual superman, not needing comfort, not needing help, not ever needing others. And I find Christ, the only spiritual superman that ever walked. And here I find him in his extremity, and he turns to his human friends. And he finds a comfort simply in the fact that they're with him. In the fact of their physical proximity, he takes with him Peter and James and John. Now Mark, who is a great theologian among the New Testament writers, he tells us that the reason that Jesus chose 12 was simply to be with them. presence, the friendship, the comfort of other human beings. And here he is in the hour of his anguish, when everything is so low, because we know from Mark that there are these storms, these clouds have been gathering now ever since Caesarea Philippi. The Lord has been going deeper and deeper, or further and further down into this emotional pit. And he turns to these men, he takes them with him, Peter, James and John. Now there are times in life when the best thing for us is human company. And I will say this to you too. These may be the very times when you least feel like company. That when you just want to be alone and left alone, you don't want anyone to hear you. Just as the critical time to keep on attending the means of grace is when you feel disinclined to go. That's when you fight that intention. It may be the day you don't want to see anybody. That may be the day when it is most important that you see somebody. Now there's something else to enshrine in the heart of this very simple affirmation, and it's this. The Lord didn't take every human being with him into the garden. He didn't even take all his disciples with him. He didn't even take the 11 with him. He took 3 with him. Now I wonder if many of us feel guilty about not loving everybody equally, about not loving all Christians equally, about not being equally fond of everybody in our own youth fellowship. Somehow we've got the idea that Christian love means that you feel the same for everybody. Now we know that Christ loved his neighbor as himself. And yet we also know that there were special circles. There were the 11. There were the 3, Peter, James and John. And within the 3 there was John, the beloved disciple. Now I don't love everybody equally in the sense of being equally happy in everybody's company. I have my own social preferences. I have my own preferred company. It depends on how well I know them. It depends on shared interests. It depends upon whether or not they can speak Gaelic and other kinds of things. But it is a fact of human nature that we all need special circles. We cannot sustain on the same level of intensity an infinite number of friendships. It was the Lord's human nature that meant that there was this preference for Peter, James and John taken with him so often into those very, very special situations. So here he is, first of all, seeking comfort in human company, especially in the company of his closest friends. Well, if you have them, you cherish them. And the second comfort was this, and it's more remarkable still. He found comfort in the prayers of these fellow men. He told them, remain here or sit here and watch. He told them to watch and to pray. Now it's a remarkable thing that God's Son would ask people to pray for him, and would find comfort and reassurance in the fact that they were interceding for him. And yet, isn't it saying to us again how close his kinship with ourselves actually was and is? We may say to one another sometimes, pray for me. It's a very great privilege to be asked to do so, one in which I accept that we so often renege. And the disciples, of course, reneged. They let the Lord down. But here was a burden, a problem he wanted to share You know, he was weak, and you know, he didn't mind them knowing he was weak. He didn't cover up as you would do. You hate people knowing that you're cracking. But the Lord didn't mind that they knew the way he felt. He told them how he felt. They could see how he felt. And they were to pray for him in respect of the way that he felt. He went for comfort to their intercession. Not only his own prayer, as we shall see, but the intercession of those believers. And they were far inferior to him, obviously. And saying to us, look, you don't go simply to the older Christians and to ones you admire. But sometimes you share burdens with those who are weaker than yourself. Have we ever done that? You know, we would say, wouldn't we? I would say, I have no right to transfer my great burden to these people. I say it all the time, I have no right to share my problems, to burden them with my problems. And if I did, I would probably go to those that one looks up to, those who are seen. But the Lord is doing something so very interesting, isn't he? He is going to those who are immeasurably his juniors. And he's praying them to pray for him. Why shouldn't you pray for college professors and for mature folk like Farquhar? Because it really is a very important thing to learn to share, not only with those that one reveres, but with those that one can regard as in some measure less experienced and less able. It was part of their education and of their discipline. There's a third remarkable comfort too, and it's this. Luke tells us that there appeared an angel from heaven to strengthen them. Now bear in mind all you're told in Hebrews 1 as to the relationship between Christ and the angels. We know how superior to them Christ was. He was their Lord, he was their Maker. In him they lived and moved and had their beings. And yet one day, one was sent to strengthen the Son of God. Now Hugh Martin, it was, I think, he said a very beautiful thing. He said, the one angel I long to meet in heaven is the one who was sent to comfort the Lord in Gethsemane. It seems to us that the strong comfort the weak, the stronger comfort the strong, the strongest comfort the stronger. It implies almost a kind of superiority. And yet one day, an angel was sent to comfort his Maker. There is nothing more remarkable in the whole range of the Lord's humiliation than that. That the Son of God, who was the angel superior in every conceivable direction, was yet in such straits and in such weakness that the creature and the servant was sent to strengthen him. And the fourth comfort was this, his own prayer. He sought solace in prayer. Always bear in mind that prayer is primarily the soul drawing near to God. It's always that idea. It's an approach to God. It is I coming with my problems, my anxieties, my interests, and spreading them before God. And that's what Christ does. He is comforted by the physical presence of the three disciples. He is comforted by their intercession. He is comforted by the angel sent to strengthen. But above all, he seeks comfort and strength in drawing near to God for himself. It was C.S. Lewis, I think, who said, when his wife was taken from him, there is no earthly comfort. One of our great hymns, "Abide with Me," says the same thing. When other helpers fail and comforts flee, help of the helpless, oh, abide with me. For the Lord had come, I'm sure, to the end of every human resource. He had used every human resource. He wasn't too proud to use human resources. But now he was at the outer limit, and he turns to God. And it is intriguing to watch the narrative of the prayer and all its fascinating details. We note, for example, this, that he went a little further, verse 35. Luke again gives us more detail. He was removed, he says, a stone's throw from the three disciples. Now, it is a reminder to us, of course, that there are times when we have to be alone with God. Bear in mind, they were still within earshot. They were still in the garden. They were with them. And yet they weren't quite with them. They weren't so near as to distract him. He was alone with his Lord and Father, his God and Father. But I think that there is something to the observation of some commentators, that it is really symbolic of the distance between Christ and the disciples, that he had outdistanced them. He went a little further. Up to a point, of course, they could understand the sorrow. But it was always up to a point. They too knew what sorrow was, what amazement was, what fear was. But not his sorrow, not his fear, not his amazement. He has outstripped them. There is an absolute singularity in the Lord's position. There is a uniqueness in his need. It was unrepeatable, it was unprecedented. Never before had man been at that point, the innocent, the incarnate, under the anathema of God. And that stone's throw to me is symbolic, really, of the uniqueness of Christ as to who he is and as to what he suffers and as to what he needs. So that I can't speak of my Gethsemane any more than I can of my Calvary, because always there is that stone's throw. And it always means, of course, that our pain can never outstrip or outmatch the experience of pain which God's Son had. My physical pain is never more than his. My emotional pain, my sorrow, my sense of being overwhelmed, my fear, can never say, Christ never hurt like this. Can never say, Christ was never as down as this. Can never say, Christ was never as afraid as this. Because always there is the stone's throw, which is the measure of the fact that his sorrow exceeds mine, and his fear and his total experience exceed mine. I never go to the outer limit. He is the outer limit. Between me and that outer limit, there is always the stone's throw. He went a little further. And then we see he fell on the ground. You see, it wasn't the cold, logical prayer of pure reason. It was the prayer of passion and the prayer of involvement. Indeed, we might render the words, he threw himself on the ground. And we know again from Luke with his details, from whoever he got them, we know that being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly. He fell on the ground to pray earnestly. Then he prayed more earnestly. And then he agonized in his earnestness. And at last, Luke tells us that his perspiration fell in great blobs of blood to the ground. So terrible was the inward struggle. We have cold sweats in times of real fear. But the Lord has this extraordinary physical symptom of his inward condition, a symptom of the agony and the earnestness and the turmoil of his own soul. Something he really wanted. It is again, is it not, a symptom of the emotional hurricane that was coursing through his soul, the storm at the center of his life. He threw himself. He prays with such passion, with such earnestness, and in such a tremendous agony. As I said before, there is a stone's throw always between us and him. And yet in our way too, we are called upon to duplicate and reproduce the commitment of Christ in prayer. Is there anything we want remotely with the same urgency as Christ wanted this, for which he longed and for which he prayed? How much passion, how much longing is there in our own desire tonight for the extension of his kingdom? Do we know anything? Do I know anything? For that kind of commitment and that kind of intensity and that kind of totally unembarrassed self-forgetfulness. He didn't say, they'll see me. They saw, they would know, the whole world would know. The angels in heaven saw him throwing himself on the ground. It was so unseemly, was it not? And yet that's how his emotion finds its expression. He goes a little further and he throws himself on the ground and then he prays. And what does he say? And the prayer itself, its actual content is interesting. Abba, Father. The Lord spoke Aramaic and the disciples remembered how he always said Abba. And they kept this Aramaic word in the Gospels, as they kept the word of great prayer, Maranatha, come, Lord Jesus. They remember that Aramaic as well. These are the exact words of Jesus, Abba. And they are interesting to me because they're an expression of the Lord's own sense of his divine sonship. An expression to the sense of God's love and God's care and God's concern in the Garden of Gethsemane. But they interest me above all for this theological reason. They are the great proof that Gethsemane was not the bottom. It was not the end of the line. It was not the lowest point in the progression towards ultimate humiliation. Because I remind you, we shall see it maybe tomorrow, that in the darkest hour, the Lord is not able to say, Abba. In the darkest hour, the Lord says, Eloi. And they remember that too. Some of the people thought he was calling on Eli. He was calling on my God. Now it may be, of course, a very small difference, linguistically and in some ways even theologically, but it is the register of a huge emotional gulf that point when the soul can say Abba, and that point when the soul can only say Elohim. Some point it can say Father, some point it says only God. And that's how it was in Gethsemane. Still Abba. Still the love was there. Still the Father was with him. There had been the angel. There was the communion. There was the open face. There was boldness. There was the certainty that God was listening. There was still the sense of God's approbation and God's love and God's approval. At the darkest point, there would be none of that. But in Gethsemane, the Father's face is still shining upon him. That's very important. And he goes on to say this: all things are possible to me. Well, you see, there is grasping for his comfort there. He's grasping at the power of God. I don't think that we often regard God's power as a comforting attribute. But if you go through the Bible, you know, take a simple concordance tonight or tomorrow, whenever. Look at the references to power. See how precious power is to God's people. I am persuaded that nothing shall be able, nothing has the power to separate me from the love of God in Christ Jesus. Now unto him who has the power to keep me from falling and to set me faultless in the face of his glory with exceeding joy. So here is comfort. It isn't the grace or the sweetness or the loveliness or the gentleness or the beauty or the love. I don't think we really believe that. That's what Jesus turned to for his own comfort. All things are possible to thee. And then the petition. Remove this cup from me. Though I hesitate to go far into this because it brings me to the edge of my own universe and I don't want to weary you. It intrigues me at one level because, you know, he knows it's God's will. You see, you say, if only I knew it was God's will, I'd find it all so easy if I knew it was God's will. Most of the time, yes. But there are times in life when you know absolutely certainly that something is God's will, and yet it's hard. He wants it different. Prayed that the hour might pass. And it's even because he's praying for the impossible. Some of the Gospels tell us that he prayed that the cup might pass. The cup. But here it is, the hour. The hour, you know, not simply an hour, not simply any hour. But the hour for which he had come, the hour upon which the whole history of the cosmos depended, the hour for which everything had been created, the hour which was the meaning of everything. It was the hour, it really was something absolutely all-embracing, foundational, something of cosmic, absolute, ultimate significance. It was the meaning of every atom of every galaxy, of every life ever lived, every soul ever born, every death ever died. It was the meaning of the Old Testament. It was the meaning of Greek philosophy. It was the meaning of World War II and Hiroshima. It was the hour that held everything together. The hour. is an amazing thing, and look, I'm right at the edge on this one. All things are possible. And he prays for the one thing which is not possible. It could have passed. Ah, yes, you say, but if it had passed, then we couldn't have been saved. And that is absolutely true. But it's only part of the truth. If that hour had passed, there would have been no meaning. There'd have been nothing. Nothing at all. He prayed that the hour might pass. And yet it isn't really simply a futile challenge to God's will. Because Hebrews tells us that he was heard in respect of what he was afraid of. He was heard. How was he possibly heard? He said, let the hour pass. He said, Father, this cup is unendurable. He said, Father, I don't know if I can handle it. So amazed, overwhelmed. But he was heard in two great senses. He was heard in that he was carried through it by the eternal Spirit. He offered himself. He actually achieved it. Bear in mind the prayer. He is almost overwhelmed. He's really asking, can my human nature handle it? Can I, my incarnate state, can I go through it? He was heard. He managed. He achieved it. It is the achievement itself that is being questioned. The possibility of the achievement that's being questioned in Gethsemane. And the prayer is answered in the achievement itself. The hour in the sense of the hour of failure. The hour of the aborted mission. That hour didn't come. Instead, we have secondly, the deliverance from death. He was heard by him who was able to deliver him from death. So we have the Lord finding comfort in prayer. If I can pick up the threads for you again. And he finds comfort in this prayer by which he goes a little further. He throws himself on the ground and he prays, Abba. He prays, all things are possible. He prays, let the hour pass. And then there's the disciples' failure. There is the Lord's emotional state. There is the comfort the Lord sought. There is the Lord's prayer. And then writ large over the whole narrative, there is the disciples' failure. Now that really is again something which gives me enormous personal satisfaction. It's one great fault of so many biographies, the Christian Church, that they are totally uncritical. When you look at the lives, for example, of many of the giants of our Christian past, and they obscured all the weaknesses and all the faults of these men. I've seen it in regard to men I've known myself, and people written great lives of those men. Not a word that there was a crack anywhere. And then after those magnificent New Testament Gospels, and they show me the heroes of the church, and how the church venerated Peter and James and John, and yet how ruthlessly, guided by God's Spirit, are their weaknesses exposed and all their human frailty made to stand forth for my comfort and for yours. Well, you see, empties. he came back. Verse 37. He came and found them sleeping, and he said, Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour? No, there is a certain irony in it too. People tell me when you edit that dreadful magazine, don't ever be ironical or sarcastic. Simon, aren't you the one who said that you would never, mark that, never forsake? Simon, did you say never? And now, 1 hour afterwards, Simon, it wasn't a very long never. I will never forsake. Simon, could you not watch 1 hour? And he went away again, you see, in verse 39. And he came and found them sleeping again. And he came the third time and said to them, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? Not once, but 3 times did they fail. And there is no glossing over of the incident at all. It stands there, recorded in all its detail, to the lasting discredit of the most important man in church. And I hope that if and when the day comes that men write not my life but my obituary, that they write it honestly, it'll do me no harm, but it may do others a lot of good. These men failed, and it's an aggravated failure. It's aggravated by their position, by their status. They were apostles. I'm sure, you know, everyone thought, well, apostles never do anything wrong. Maybe they thought themselves that their very position would keep them from temptation and keep them in temptation. But no, they fell. These apostles fell. Now, there isn't a man in the free church, no matter how eminent, who's above that possibility. And it is part of our ministry to God's people, those of us who are leaders and teachers, and those of you destined to become leaders and teachers. Your weakness, your experience of personal failure, is part of what you have to share with the church. Don't pretend that, unlike the poor folk you minister to, you never let the Lord down, because that only discourages them. Peter, you know, no, I never forgot. In his 50th epistle, he tells us beautifully that God begat him again to a living hope by the resurrection of Jesus. All my hope had gone. I'd failed him in Gethsemane. I denied him in the Praetorium. And all my hope was gone. But God gave me back my hope. An apostle. And he failed. And it was known for the comfort of God's people. Even Peter let him down. And they failed to, despite their experiences. They'd had tremendous experiences. They'd been with the Lord for well over a year. They'd had tremendous teaching. They'd had a tremendous example set before them. Let me put it to you this way. Suppose I were pastor of some congregation, and some members of that congregation, or even the whole congregation, suppose they did something wrong. Do you know what they'd be saying? They couldn't have had much teaching. Couldn't have been much of a preacher, much of a pastor. Because you know how his people live and what they've done. If they'd been properly taught, wouldn't have happened. Well, you apply that to the present situation. Would you say they hadn't been properly taught? Properly led? Guided? Did he spend enough time with them? Did he do enough visiting? Give them enough counseling? Could you blame him for what went wrong? Not for a moment. Of course, people would. But we can't do it. Despite all the teaching they had. You know something else? Only an hour before, they'd been at something even better than a Free Church Youth Conference. They'd been with the Lord in the upper room around the Last Supper. And that meant they had sat through the whole magnificent communion address that we have from John 14 to John 16. And they'd heard a prayer such as men never heard before or since, recorded for us in John 17. And they had got the elements from the Lord himself. The one Lord's Supper at which the Lord was actually corporally and physically present. He'd been there. Well, you know, you'd have thought that they'd have gone years and years in the strength of that. An unforgettable experience. And it was. There really, I'm sure, was never a moment in human history comparable to that, except Pentecost itself. What did it do? An hour afterwards, they're asleep, letting the Lord down. And you must never imagine because you belong to a certain church, or a certain teaching, or been to a certain conference or a certain college, or had enormous privileges, that that's going to keep you. Because these people had all these things, and they go, and they're dismal failures. 1 hour, that was all it took. Whatever they had, they seem to have lost. Well, I must bring this to a conclusion. Why did they fail? I'll go through it very rapidly. They failed, first of all, because, to put it brutally, they were tired. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. The Lord himself knows that. And it's terribly important for you young folk, for some middle-aged man to tell you how important it is that you present your bodies living sacrifices to God. Their bodies, their physical condition, led these people into spiritual problems. If you have an exhausted body, or an anorexic body, or an obese body, or an under-exercised body, or a pampered body, then it's going to lead you into spiritual trouble. The spirit indeed willing, but the flesh just isn't up to it. The body won't do it. It can't stay away because you haven't had enough sleep. Diet is wrong, whatever else it is, no fresh air. Present your bodies living sacrifices to God. But then again, there was this. There was sorrow. Luke, it is, I think it tells us, they were sleeping for sorrow. And I just mentioned to you for this reason that there is a strand of teaching in the churches, and always has been, that somehow sorrow, suffering is good for you. Prosperity, pleasure, to be happy is dangerous. But to be sorrowful, that's always safe and always good for you. Not at all. These people were sorrowful because they knew, they could tell, that something terrible, something unthinkable was going to happen. They didn't know what it was, but they knew there was something terrible coming. And they were sleeping, Luke says, for sorrow. Now I tell you, many a time, bereavement, illness, bad news, and all these things are really terribly dangerous spiritually. And you say to yourself, the moment you find yourself in sorrow or trouble, say to yourself, I'm in danger. There is danger in sorrow, at least as much as there is danger in prosperity. And then there was this. They failed because of their supreme self-confidence. Peter is the archetype. Though all should forsake thee, I will never forsake thee. I will go to prison and to death with you. Well, that was the trouble. That at last is the great contrast of Gethsemane. The Lord who knows that he cannot unaided handle God's will, and who throws himself on the ground as he seeks God's help to do God's will and to drink the cup. And the disciples, we don't feel half so weak, don't feel half so in danger, and therefore don't pray. We don't feel weak enough to pray, because that's what prayer is. It is impotence screaming to omnipotence. But they weren't impotent. Well, they had much to learn. They learned the only way that men, I'm afraid, and women can learn it, by experience. At terrible personal cost, they had to learn that they couldn't handle the will of God. And let's ask ourselves tonight, just how self-sufficient do we feel? Do I feel that tomorrow's address is okay, no problem? Do you feel the seminars are no problem, that witness is no problem, that work is no problem, you can handle it? It is that self-reliance that brought these people so close to spiritual catastrophe. It is really absolutely magnificent. A weak, praying Saviour and three strong, prayerless disciples. But at the end of the night, it is he, not they, who are fit for the will of God. Well, I shall read it.